again, everyone. I'm Bill Gallagher, Scaling Coach, host of the Scaling Up Business Podcast. Before we get into it, I want to talk about one of our sponsors. And I think many of our companies face one of the biggest challenges is getting technology developed, right? Finding the right technology partner. And even if you have some in-house tech teams, you're often looking to complement that. Or maybe you're some kind of traditional business, you've got no tech team at all. If you're looking for a technology partner, you know it's really important to find that proven expertise, but finding that right fit, somebody who's got a delivery model, a process for working with you, who's sized like Goldilocks to the particular situation that you're dealing with, whose cost and balance between quality and agile development works together at your level and your stage, who can bring resources to bear, ramp up quickly and up and down, can make a huge difference. I've come across a lot of companies like this, but one of our own scaling up companies is a scaling up venture incubator based in India that has a great sort of formula recipe for doing tech development for our clients and really balances that too by being a scaling up company. They know and understand your world and your way of working. Their model is totally tailored to companies like yours, so they can have quite a bit of advantage over other vendors that you might outsource to. That company is Clarion Technologies. And if you think it might be a match, go check them out. Have a conversation with them. bit.ly/Clarion Technology is a quickie link with some more information and where to get more and that kind of thing. bit.ly/Clarion Technology is the link. We'll put that up there for you as well. Hi, everyone. As I said, I'm Bill Gallagher, Scaling Coach, host of the Scaling It Business Podcast. And our show is all about how to grow and develop your business, no matter what's happening in the world, in the economy, what industry, what part of the world you're in. And you can find hundreds of episodes on all the topics to deal with people, strategy, execution, cash, and even the leadership required to grow and develop your company, all that and more at scalingcoach.com. I want to welcome Michael. Michael, pronounce your name for the listeners so they get it right, because they'll read it on the screen and they'll be like...
Michael Cardamone. Although, you know, my Italian grandparents would say Cardamone, but...
Cardamone. Cardamone.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk today about funding your SaaS business, funding your business in general. And because I think the same ideas apply. How do you get involved in this? What's your background? Give folks a little bit more about how you come to be involved in and focused on funding in particular.
Yeah. So I'm originally from upstate New York, but wanted to get into tech.
There you go.
Yeah, we moved to San Francisco in 2008, and you know, basically just got lucky and ended up at Box when it was about 25 people. And looking back on it, like I literally had no idea how to think about a company. Like people are like, "Oh my God, you must have been so smart. You ended up at Box. Now it's a big company." I was like, I had no idea how to think about equity value, how to think about like the likelihood of a company getting big. It was really just like a small team, a fun culture, and they were giving me way more responsibility than I frankly deserved at the time. And so decided to do it. I knew so little about tech at the time. I, you know, coming from New York and business school, I literally showed up to the interview in a suit, and Aaron Levy asked me if I was going to the prom afterwards. So it was a nice intro to the tech world. And now here I am wearing t-shirts all the time. But so anyway, I did that for a little bit. I went to another startup in the ed tech space that we grew to about $24 million in revenue and left there in 2014 and was kind of seeing this, like, you know, obviously 2008 was like the early shift to the cloud, but in 2014 felt like there was a lot of momentum behind the shift to the cloud, but I felt like it was still in the early innings. There was a lot of opportunity to kind of get involved in helping to facilitate that next kind of wave of that shift from on-prem to cloud and to, you know, to SaaS products. And there were a lot of generalist accelerators out there, like YC and Techstars and 500 Startups, but there were only a few in the country focused on B2B SaaS. And I got fixated on that. I was doing a little bit of angel investing. I was doing some consulting, helping companies with go-to-market, but got fixated on this idea that B2B SaaS-focused accelerator was able to convince a critical mass of people from my network who I was fortunate enough to have met in my experiences who were part of that first wave of SaaS companies. So a lot of like early Salesforce, early Marketo, early Box, you know, CEO of Zuora, CEO of Gainsight, like a lot of really good kind of SaaS operators to get involved. Was able to pull together a tiny first fund back in 2014 to kind of test the concept. And now, you know, fast forward about, I guess, coming on 7 years now, we're on our fourth fund for the accelerator. We've worked with like over 200 companies at that like founding team, may or may not have customers, like very pre-seed, often first check-in. So we've worked with about 200 of those that have gone to raise, I think, like well over $300 million in follow-on funding now from a bunch of brand name funds. And then also have a seed fund now as well that invests in kind of more traditional institutional seed rounds, usually like $1 to $4 million rounds that we're investing in out of that fund as well. So have had a lot of data points to learn from over the last 7 years of helping kind of early stage companies through the fundraising process.
That's really incredible, right? you know something about something in this world. And I think we have an increasing number of listeners, viewers in SaaS, in particular B2B SaaS, a lot. And even more than here in the Bay Area, where we're based, is our global reach, like folks in other parts of the world who are seeing like, oh, I don't have to necessarily be in the Bay Area. The Bay Area has advantages for recruiting talent and that talent pool. But as we've seen, especially in the last year, being flexible in where you attract people from is, you know, just really amazing what folks have realized. They don't necessarily have to have an office dressed out the way that we used to think about the office.
Yeah. I mean, just to give an anecdote around that, we have a company called First Base. The founders originally from Scotland came over to New York to be part of our kind of pre-seed accelerator program. We then invested in the seed round. He then recently raised the Series A from Andreessen, and he tweeted recently, actually, I saw him tweet it, that he's never, and to be fair, he's building a remote company, solving a problem for other companies trying to build remote. So like very much in their ethos, but he tweeted that he's never stepped foot in Silicon Valley, and he's now raised, you know, from, you know, he's raised like close to $20 million from like, you know, Andreessen did the A, and like he's growing quickly. He's building a global team that's fully distributed in a bunch of different markets, and he's literally never stepped foot in San Francisco. So I think to your point, like increasingly that's going to become more normalized and kind of democratize opportunity for people all over the world, I think. I don't think it's not the case anymore where you have to be in San Francisco to build out the team and to fundraise.
Yeah, people would try and trek here, right, from around the world to do the march and make pitches up and down Sandhill and around the Bay, but that's become far less important. And certainly being around here and hearing people talk about what they're doing led you to think about, oh, if we raise money, we could do like this, and then we could add that, and we could hire that, and then we could leverage this. And you started to think about things differently and things that could scale, that being involved in that environment, but we're not really limited that way anymore. Yeah. In that thinking about problems. And, you know, we've had people on the show in the past talk about exponential organizations. We've had Chris Yeh on talk about blitz scaling and things like that. The notion and the way of looking at the world, let's do something and let's solve a problem and let's do it on a big global scale is really like core to that, right?
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, I think there was a time not that long ago where a lot of the Sandhill Road investors would require companies to come to San Francisco for them to fund it. Like I think Shopify was like famous for that, where like a lot of funds passed because they didn't want to move to San Francisco. And then Bessemer ended up obviously doing it, which was, you know, obviously a massive home run for them. But that wasn't that long ago that was the mentality. And that pendulum has completely swung. Like I think there's actually a lot of funds who would prefer you take advantage of the benefits of hiring global talent so that you're not restricted in finding people with certain skills within like a 20-mile radius of where your physical location is. And so, yeah, I think that that is clearly changing. And I think it's going to create a lot of opportunities for people that in the past may have struggled because they didn't want to or couldn't move to San Francisco or other key tech markets.
And then also benefited from different cost structures of talent and diversity of perspective, right? You traffic around a place like the Bay Area, San Francisco, you develop a kind of a mindset, right? Yeah. You go and do this in Austin, you do it in Southern California, you do it in Toronto, in Vancouver. I mean, we work with teams all over the world, and it's a really, like, the way that they work and operate is really, really different. And it doesn't have to be from here to raise a lot of money or to do something substantial.
Yeah, I think so. We have offices. I'm in New York now, in the New York area, and we have offices in New York, San Francisco, and Toronto. And I think there's still something about, which is going to take a little while to propagate out to other markets, something about the San Francisco market and mindset of like, of just like pure ambition and like wild, like dreaming of like how big you can build something. Like we work with a lot of founders in Toronto who are incredibly talented, very skilled, and they're more focused on kind of like the short term execution and like how they get from like point A to point B. And sometimes you have to kind of coach them on what is the big picture? What's the big vision? How do you inspire people to want to come work with you and work for you and build a big company? So I think it'll take time for that sort of like kind of San Francisco Bay Area mentality of like swing for the fences type mentality to kind of propagate out to other markets. But the more and more that companies go remote and distributed, the more that mindset is going to start creeping into other markets. And I think, you know, I think generally that will be good for companies.
Well, there's like ambition in the Bay Area. And there's also a different way of looking at the world. Like we could build something, you know, extraordinary. We could accomplish something huge really quickly and surprise people. And that isn't true. I mean, we have we work with SaaS companies all over, and we have a Canadian one, one or two right now. And one of the things that I remind them all the time is that their pace is a little slower at scaling some of the others because of their perspective. Like what they're trying to accomplish is more modest. People say, how do I double my business? I say, play a 10X game. You want to double your business. You work at doubling your business. You'll spend years doing it. You think about how to 10X or 100X your business. Doubling happens fast along the way, right? Yeah. It's a different way of looking at things.
It is. Yeah.
Okay. So fundamental and so simple. Like, and we struggle with it sometimes. Like how to 10X your business is not an easy thing. Like you really have to reimagine stuff in order to do that. So talk about some of the others. You mentioned in preparation SOAT.
What's that? Okay. Yeah. Okay. I mentioned them. So they're building. I was a small and early angel investor in a company called Flexport, which is building like a tech enabled, they're a fully licensed custom broker and like freight forwarder, and they're building it with tech from the ground up and have scaled immensely. I mean, they're a multi-billion dollar company now and I think, you know, and still growing very quickly in just what is a massive, massive industry with a lot of incumbents who are largely still fairly analog or at least like not leveraging technology as well as they should. SOTE is building
in freight forwarding.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's still fax machines in that industry.
Yeah. So SOTE is building something similar to what Flexport is doing for Africa. And I saw a lot of similar dynamics, there. And one of the reasons I called them out is, you know, in thinking about kind of this theme around fundraising and like, how do you think about fundraising and strategies around that? You know, one of the things that founders don't think about enough is like how are investors going to evaluate your business and like what is their process? Like where do you stand in that process? And oftentimes one of the pieces of that process is if a fund is interested, they're going to write a memo and build out a memo around your opportunity. And then they're going to talk about it as a partnership and they're going to make a decision. And increasingly, we're seeing a lot of our companies, which I think is really smart. And SOTE did this in a really really nice way is just write their own memo for their own company. It like reduces friction in the process, just like a sales process.
Make it easy.
Friction, but it also just like forces you to really think about how are investors going to think about your business? Like, what are the risks they're going to be thinking about? And like, what proof points or data points can you show to help them get more comfortable around those risks? And it just shows a level of like thought around your business and your market and how it's evolving and how you can win in that market. And so Sote wrote this like really long, very well thought out memo for their own business. And it wasn't all like roses, like everything's amazing. It was like, hey, here are the risks. Like, here's how we're thinking about them. Here's what we're doing to kind of help mitigate those risks. Here's how we think the market's evolving and like why we think we can win in that market. And I just think they did a really good job with it. And I think more and more companies should do that, because just like in a sales process where you're trying to arm the people you're selling with to help sell it internally, like it does the same thing in a fundraising process. And it like reduces that friction in that process and can kind of shorten that process a bit. And it helps the investors like really think about it. You may have things in the memo that they weren't even thinking about that they'll appreciate. So I thought that was a really interesting approach that I'm now seeing happening more and more. And they ended up, you know, successfully raising a $3 million seed round from great investors.
You know, I think what is great in that I hear in that is anticipating and addressing the objections beforehand versus hoping they don't come up. There's a lot of reasonable objections or concerns, risks to any sale, to any business, to any funding. And if you're hoping that they don't come up, rather than actively addressing them, mitigating them, explaining them, or bundling them into the pitch, right? Like, okay, that's why we're raising the money, because we need it to work on that piece. Like, that's just thoughtful.
We tell our founders to like really think of the fundraising process as a sales process and treat it like that. And you know, part of that is like, you know, you want to find investors that could be a fit based on companies they've invested in or spaces they've invested in or things they're talking about. But then you want to book as many meetings as you can in a short window of time to help create urgency and momentum in the process. And then you need to be like relentless about taking notes during all those meetings and like reflecting on the conversations. What are the objections they're bringing up? What are the questions they have? Did you have good answers for those? If not, like really write those out to the point where like you may even have like a written out FAQ that investors are asking with answers pre-written that you can just share with investors ahead of time. Like to your point, getting ahead of the objections and like making it clear that you've thought about them. And like every business has risks, especially early stage businesses. There's always going to be risks. They just want to understand, have you thought through them? Have you thought through how you mitigate them and like how you're going to navigate them? And like, you know, I think the more you can be upfront about that and the more thorough you can be around that, the better. And so, yeah, I think like it allows you to iterate as you're having these meetings if you're like really good about taking meticulous notes throughout. We had a company called Indio where they did a great job of like, he was just really, really good at running a process around his fundraising. And like, you know, I think he did 20 like very targeted first meetings. He was tracking how many went to second meetings, but like during those first meetings, he was taking notes on the conversations. He was understanding where people were hung up. He was kind of thinking through the answers, getting feedback from people, advisors, from us, from other people on like, am I answering this in a way that makes sense? Like, is this clear to you? Do you feel like it would get you more comfortable around this risk? And then he was kind of continuing to iterate during those conversations. And again, like successfully fundraised and ended up going on to raise an A and then a B, and then his company ended up getting acquired in a great, great outcome. But he was like really good about running it like a sales process. And I think founders need to do that.
Yeah. And so that's true of selling, fundraising, whatever, like outline a process and then refine it. Yeah. And if you go through that, start to tune it. So the first page is a stage is kind of developmental. You're tweaking and iterating on things. And then you put in some big course corrections, and then you start really adding volume behind whatever it is after you've sort of worked out the basics of that pit.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's right. The other thing that I think can be frustrating for founders during the fundraising process is I can't tell you how many times I've heard this from founders of like, you know, they say, oh, they told us we were too early, but if we get to like X amount of revenue, they might be interested. Or they see some other company in their space raise around and they know they were at, you know, some amount of revenue. And they're like, I just need to get to that amount of revenue and like, I'll be able to fundraise. And the reality is like, it's just not tied to like some random arbitrary specific revenue number. Like that's not what it's about. It's all about like, again, like how investors are going to look at it. So they're going to look at it like, okay, every investor wants to invest in a great founder. What does that mean? Like every investor says they want to invest in a great founder. That's like, it's so subjective and arbitrary. Cause like, I don't know, like look at Honey sold for $4 billion. Those founders started like six companies before they started Honey. Was it obvious they were quote unquote great founders? Like they built a massive business, but failed six times before it. Like they obviously were great founders, but wasn't clear based on their background. So I think when investors say that, what they really mean is like, can this person recruit great people around them? Which, you know, one rubric might be like, would I work for this? Like, are they so inspiring around the vision and the opportunity and how big this can get? It like, would the investor, could they picture themselves working for them if they weren't doing what they were doing? And so I think founders, again, just like reframe, how are investors thinking about you and how do you then prove that out to them or get them excited? And so part of that is like your energy level, your ability to like with clarity and conviction talk about how your market's evolving and how you're going to win in that market and why you're going to win and like what early signs or early data points do you have to like make that believable? And then like how big can that get? So that's one example of like just really understanding the market. You know, how do you build momentum, which obviously revenue and traction is one way to build momentum, but there's a lot of ways to build momentum, like pipeline growth and, you know, press, you know, a following on social media, building a wait list. Like there's a lot of ways to build momentum that doesn't always have to be revenue and traction that will still create urgency in a fundraising process. So yeah, I think there's just a lot that founders can really hone in on to get better at fundraising. And a lot of that is just thinking about it from the lens of the investor and how they're going to evaluate the opportunity and what they care about.
So we use a leadership flywheel for our leaders at scale and our leadership coaching that we've spent many years developing. And it's a best of thing, applying a lot of great learnings from a range. But the first piece is that emotional thing. How do we convey passion and vision and boldness? And that whole first piece is designed to produce an emotional response. And I hear that in what you're speaking to. Does the leader show up and talk about a big problem that they're tackling in a new, fresh, and innovative way? Do they paint a picture of an altered future, right? That like we get excited about that. We get inspired by that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I hear also attracting and retaining the team. So it's one thing to get people excited about working with you, but if they don't see a role for themselves, you said, would the investor consider working for that team? Like if you can not only paint a inspiring vision for the future and get people lit up about it, but then you can show them how they could be a part of it and connect it, and you start to attract capable, strong, intelligent people around you, like you're leaning to that second discipline of R4. And then I also heard you touching on what we talk about in the planning piece. Have they thought through all the parts and the steps and the way, and are they plotting multiple paths to things with a clear-headed view of not only the best case, but also some very likely ways they might fail?
Yeah.
And what are some of the risks and how they might address some of those? Of course, you won't necessarily fail in the ways that you imagined. You will encounter something that you didn't imagine. But the more flexible you are in thinking about, well, it could go wrong like this, it could go wrong like that, and having some backup plans makes a big difference.
For sure.
It's interesting how the SaaS funding is not too different from any kind of funding and not too different from any kind of sales. It's more sometimes sales can be pretty simple and straightforward, but if you think about a large complex sale, it's a lot like that. There's going to be multiple people weighing in on this. It's not usually a single, in your angel round, you're going to get people who will fund you with money based on a conversation sometimes rather than a lot. But you're thinking about something. So you're creating and mapping out a process. You're treating it like a project. You're thinking about the perspective of the other party. What do they want? What will their concerns be? You're addressing that. You're baking that into the things. You talked about taking boatloads of notes.
And so, like, just when you're, to your point, like when you're selling, I think there's a lot of analogies there of like, you want to understand your buyer and not just your buyer as like the company you're trying to sell to, but like actually the person you're trying to sell to, like, what do they care? What is their comp
type? The actual person.
Yeah. Like, what are they, what are the personal goals for them? And like, how do you help them accomplish that? And it's the same thing on the investor, like, you know, a fund will have specific goals, but there's also a lot of dynamics that founders aren't even aware of kind of in the background that are like specific to the person at the fund. Like it could be, you know, you're trying to make partner. And so you care a lot about getting like a quick markup. So you want to understand, like, is this company, do you see a realistic path for this company to go from like seed to A in like the next 12 months or 9 months? And like, is that going to make you look good so you get your promotion into being a partner? Or are you a new partner and you're trying to prove yourself? Or are you about to go out and raise a new fund? And so again, like you care about that markup, or you care about like what other brand name investors are co-investing with you. Like there's a lot of dynamics that are so specific to the individual investor and or the fund that are tied to things that are completely irrelevant to the company, but like make a big difference in how they're going to make a decision. And so that's another piece that like, I don't think founders are thinking about that or aware of that, and rightfully so, like it's completely unrelated to them. But just like in sales, like you, the more you understand about your buyer, or in this case, your investor, at a personal level and like career, like how it impacts their career and their day to day, I think the more successful you'll be able to be and the more tailored you can be to kind of how you narrate your pitch.
It's interesting you touch on the very human, very basic uniqueness of the people that you're dealing with, right? There are the broad terms of what is this fund like or what are that. But what about that one person? I'm reminded immediately, some years ago, we visited the West Wing of the White House, and one of my old mentors' son went to work for Obama in the first Obama administration. And this guy by the name of Awanate Kobina, and he was head of, I forget, special assistant to the president for legislative affairs or something like that. Right. Sounded very fancy. And I thought, wow, he must be writing like lots of policy stuff. He's like, no. Here's what I do. I figure out how to take care of senators and congressmen and their staff from both parties without antagonizing them, like making them feel good. So we cultivate, you know, and we're carefully managing what they care about. So we have friendship and maximum leverage, because we are not always aligned on our issues. They have constituencies they're trying to support and so on. So we certainly don't want to aggravate them personally. So we think about that. And, you know, it might come down to like helping them take their high school friend around the West Wing or something like that. Like, he's like, it was just deeply personal, or diverting someone down this hallway so they didn't run into somebody that they were currently antagonistic with in another hallway at the same time, like understanding and orchestrating all that so that nobody was unnecessarily triggered.
Yeah.
And felt as good as possible in light of the circumstances. And then sometimes intentionally, like pushing it because they were pissing somebody off, like reminding them, you know, something like, so thoughtful about the personal psychology of each thing, right?
Everyone's human. It makes such a difference it's also like, you want to get to know that person because you're going to be working with them for the next 6, 7, 8 years. Like if you're successful and you build a big company, like you're going to be working with that investor for a long time. Like you want to build trust quickly. You want to feel comfortable working with them. You want to build good rapport. Like people want to work with people they like working with. Like there's definitely a big element of like just building rapport and trust. And I think founders who can do that quickly, it's a big bonus for them. Like, you know, if you can build trust quickly with investors, which, you know, there's a lot of ways to kind of do that, I think.
You know, it's interesting. So in early sales and pitching trainings and experiences, I learned to pay attention to the subtle small cues. What does the person's office look like? Do they have pictures of their family? Do they have whatever? Do they have those successories posters stuck around? Do they, what are they wearing? Like, what's their whole environment like? What are all the little cues? And today, that's gotten a little harder because people have moved to Zoom. So, you know, like, what would I say about you? Well, it's a white background, right? Yeah. You've got what look like corded iPhone cords around. And you're wearing a t-shirt. And, you know, like I would guess things, and also from your appearance, right, a certain amount of like leanness. And so youthful, maybe active, doesn't rely on artificial kind of, oh, I don't need to wear a suit or that kind of thing, has a kind of a practical down-homeness, is, fits in with this vibe, is not like overly preoccupied with tech. And the wired headphones could be because you don't want to have wireless interruptions. Except they also don't give particularly good audio. So my guess is you're just pragmatic and expedient with things.
I usually use AirPods, but I figured these would be better audio than the AirPods, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, probably worse, actually. Well, you get less crackles and pops, maybe. Okay. And you can have a little bit, but the AirPods are pretty good in that regard. There is more risk of touching that microphone. Bump your shirt or that kind of thing. Anyway.
Maybe I did that wrong then.
Right. But I don't know if any of that's right. I'm like, but thinking about and picking up on all those cues is really useful. You talked earlier about somebody showing up in a suit to make a bunch of pitches. I remember once I was working at a very large telecom company and we were very suity, and certainly with senior meetings with strategic partners, that kind of thing. I flew out to San Francisco and I went to a meeting. I had like a banking meeting or some other thing. And then I went from there to Levi's. And I'm still like in a suit. I've never felt so uncomfortable. I like apologized. I'm like, look, I'm sorry. I know you guys are Levi, but I'm, you know.
I mean, my story was with my first interview with Box when I was like meeting the CEO of Box back in the day in 2008. I showed up in a suit and I've never felt so uncomfortable. He was in like shorts and a t-shirt and asked me, he started the interview by asking me if I was going to the prom after the interview and if that's
right. That's what you're saying.
So it was like I took off the tie and jacket and I was just like, didn't start off well.
you should have apologized for forgetting his corsage. It's funny. And in the beginning of doing something like that, you don't have like an abundance of swagger, so you can't just smack talking back with. So we want to talk about some of the resources and distill out some things like that. Before I do that, let me just remind folks that choosing a technology partner, like having technical development, getting your projects done is a huge challenge for companies scaling, especially if you're taking a somewhat non-technical company and making it more technology enabled. If you're looking for a partner, in addition to looking for that like basic expertise, you're concerned with finding the right fit, finding the appropriate delivery model, balancing the quality of the work with agile and process, and being able to ramp up and down the team to suit your demands over time. And so there's a lot of people in that world. I've come across a lot of them. You've heard from many of them, but one from the Scaling Up world itself is a Scaling Up venture incubator in India. That because they're a scaling up company, they're going to be a lot closer to your way of looking and working at things than you might imagine from other vendors in India. And they've got a model that's totally tailored to companies in the scale up space in that mid market, and can produce huge value compared to so many. So I suggest you check them out, see if they're in fact a fit for your business. Bit.ly /Clarion Technology is a link to some more information. You can tell them a little bit about you and have a conversation, see if it's not useful for you. So bit.ly/Clarion Technology is where to go get more info. So let's talk about a few of those like core ideas or recap some of that stuff and make sure that we covered kind of all the things. So you talked about running it like a sales process, planning for a range of things, developing it, honing it over time, right? Understanding that. Thinking about your business from the perspective, you talked about writing a memo or pre-writing a memo, but even if you don't do that, like getting in the mindset of how they're going to evaluate your business or your sale. We didn't talk, and you talked about building momentum, right? And it's not necessarily just users and sales, but it could be the growth of the pipeline, the interest, trials, any number of other kinds of things. Also, the advanced stage of your demo or working product, the size and growth and pace of your team, all of that can make a difference in that. How about the valuation?
Yeah. Valuation is a big one because it's a hard number to come up with. What I found is at the early stage, especially if you're raising quote unquote, an institutional round where there's like a lead investor. And we can talk about other ways, like, you know, there's obviously other ways to do it, but the most traditional way is like, there's a lead investor who's setting the price, writing the largest check. And then you kind of fill in the round around that investor. Right. We're talking about like, if you're raising like a, you know, institutional seed round. In that case, like that lead investor often has very pretty stringent like ownership requirements. Like they want to own a certain amount of your business to make their math work on their fund for their LPs to return capital. And so, you know, almost always the amount you're raising is going to dictate the valuation in those scenarios, right? Like most of those rounds get done at kind of 15 to 25% dilution. We found the average over a lot of data points is like right around that kind of 20% range. And so it's just, you know, if you can raise 2 million and you have enough momentum to get that many investors, like it's just going to get done at, call it 10, you know, 8 to 12 with like 10 being the average. You know, there are obviously always exceptions if a company gets like really hot, but like that's generally where it will get priced. So then the question is like, okay, how do you come up with the amount you want to raise? And that's a function of two things. One is like a practical sense of like, how much money do you need to get to the next milestones and what are those next milestones? And so like really modeling that out and understanding how much you need. And part of it is just like, how much momentum do you have as a company? And like, can you raise that amount? And sometimes those are aligned and sometimes they're not. Like sometimes you can raise a lot more than you actually really need. Then the question is like, do you do it just for the sake of doing it because it's available to you? And like, what are the repercussions of doing that? There are pros and cons of it. But yeah, so part of it is just like sitting down, modeling out your business, saying like, okay, what are the triggers or things that you can change in your business that will allow you to grow and get to the milestones you want to do? And then like, if you had more or less of those, could you grow faster and therefore, you know, get to those milestones quicker? And if so, then like test kind of the model of like layering in what more money would look like now. If it's a party round where there's a lot of investors, kind of smaller checks from smaller funds or angel investors, there's less of that ownership requirement. And so sometimes like the valuation isn't exactly aligned with that like 20% dilution. But more often than not, like that, the amount you're raising tends to be the biggest driver of valuation. And then, you know, then the key is figuring out like how much should you raise and how much can you raise.
So let's talk about some of the pitfalls, because I think we're touching on a few indirectly, but I think taking money from the wrong people, it can create massive headaches. And I think taking too much money too soon can create massive headaches. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I'll touch on the second one first. There's two pieces to that. One is just the idea of taking too much money too soon. So one is like, if you take a bunch of money, let's say you're pre-product market fit, and it takes a long time to kind of get there, you run the risk of then having to layer in more money again at like a flat round or not too much of a more than what your last round was at, and then you start to lose momentum as a company in the ecosystem of the investor sphere, because everyone talks to each other and like it's going to look like you have to raise like a bridge round because you didn't get enough accomplished, when the reality is like you just raised at too high of a valuation. If you had raised it lower, it would have been fine. So I think that's part of it, is just like understanding how much have you proven out as a company, and is raising more money right now just because you can going to benefit you? And if you're still figuring out like who your ICP is and whether there's even product market fit there, I think it can be dangerous to raise too much. The other piece of that is like sometimes when rounds get too big at the seed stage, or get too big is relative, but get bigger than like, we see rounds now where it used to be a seed round was like 1 to 2, maybe 3 million. Now people are raising like $5 to $10 million and calling it a seed round. And a lot of times when that happens, it's because some big multi-stage brand name fund came in and they say like, we want to lead your round, but we need to deploy X amount of capital, and we have certain ownership, and like they wanted other people involved, and it just like balloons. And those funds tend to be a little bit less price sensitive. So they don't mind with the price going up a little bit, because they're viewing it as just like optionality of like, if this goes, we want to back up the truck and deploy 50 million, 100 million into like subsequent rounds if it becomes the one that goes. But then you run the risk of signaling, right? Like if you have one of these big multi-stage brand name funds that do the seed round and it's not going amazingly well, and they decide they're not going to back up the truck and do the Series A and Series B, then you run the risk of like, well, why aren't they doing that? What's wrong? What's happening? And so, yeah, I think you got to be careful about the round dynamic, who's in the round, what are their intentions in the round, and then like how much are you raising and why? And what's the valuation, and like, what are the milestones you think you can get to from that? And like, what valuation do you think you can raise at, based on those milestones? And just be very cognizant of that as founders, because it's enticing, understandably, to raise like a big round if it's available to you at a high valuation. But yeah, you just got to think through like, what are the...
I think it also can lead to sloppy. So if for sure you can get more pressure, and you can set expectations for producing bigger results faster like that. But it also can lead to sloppiness, poor control in your spending, burning through a lot of money before you've done a lot, and not thinking about how you're using the money that you've got. Somebody asked me once in the 90s, when I'd raised some money for a SaaS business, if you can believe it back then, well, what would you have done if you had raised 5 million, right? Instead of a fifth of that, right? Like, and I'm like, well, I'd have made the same mistakes in a far more glorious fashion. Because I needed to learn things, right? But I would have done it with better furniture or like
that. Yeah, I think it's true. I mean, you'll hire quicker when maybe ahead of like where you maybe should have or need to. You'll spend more on testing different marketing channels than you otherwise would have before you figured out what's working. So yeah, for sure, you'll overspend on things because you'll feel pressure to spend the money.
I don't have to.
Not every founder does that. Like, we've seen founders be very pragmatic even when they raise big rounds, but certainly that temptation is there and that pressure is there.
And if you're a particularly exuberant founder, it's great to temper and balance yourself with somebody who's a more deliberate, conservative ops finance manager.
Yeah.
And then the other one I see, and I see this a lot now, especially because we're less involved in directly in the funding and often in the aftermath of trying to scale between and during the rounds. And we will see people with board members representing different investors that are really counterproductive. Board members who have profoundly different views on what the priorities should be for the company and where they're going. People who simply aren't helpful, have no expertise. What are some of the things that you worry about?
It's a good question. I think part of it is just at the end of the day, it's the founder's company. And so I think as a board, like you need to make sure there's governance and help think through strategic decisions. But the reality is, like, you made a bet on the founder. Hopefully they have more context on the business and the market than you probably have as a board member. And so I think that where you run into issues sometimes is when board members can be really hands-on around strategy to the point where they like really fundamentally disagree with the founder and they're at like a stalemate. And then it comes down to like, are they going to replace the CEO or, you know, are they just going to like agree to disagree? But yeah, I think it's just people who are, you know, board members should be really good listeners, should jump in when they have a way to help or like have some ideas and thoughts. But at the end of the day, it should be the founder taking in all of that feedback and input and making the final decision because they have the most context to make that decision.
But think about like even subsequent rounds, right? Okay, you've gone through some stuff, you've done some work. Now you're pulling in the next round and you've got a board member from an earlier round who's objecting, who's holding it up with potentially just silly vanity nonsense, right? Determined by their ego sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that's certainly going to happen. I think the venture world and like right now we're certainly in a market where the pendulum has swung to the founder. Like the founder in a lot of cases is more in control than the investor. And, you know, if you're an investor who builds a reputation around being difficult and like blocking rounds or like blocking an acquisition because it's only a 3x for you and you want them to keep building, but it's like life-changing money for the founder. Like, I think those are hard stances to take in a market like we're in today where your reputation is, you know, the best founders have the pick of who they want to work with. And if you've got that reputation, they're just not going to work with you. And so I think investors are very cognizant of that, you know, and they just need to be careful about it.
Yeah. Think about what drives them. What do they need you to win? Are they just placing a bunch of bets and you're close enough? Like that whole range of it. Yeah. So if you want more information on Michael's group and work, Forum VC is the link to go to. We'll put forumvc.com up in the crawl and we'll put it in the show notes as well. So you can follow up Michael Cardamone. Or as his family would say, Michael Cardamone.
Thanks a lot for having me, Bill.
We should meet in Italy and have this conversation over better food.
That would be amazing.
Right? We should all be traveling again. Hey, if our show helped you, please share it, like, subscribe, get them every week. We bring 3 shows a week to you, all to do with the world of scaling up. There's hundreds of shows now and more at scalingcoach.com. You can search the whole back catalog for all things to do with people, strategy, execution, cash, and the fifth decision that we like to talk about, leadership. Big thanks to Vern Harnish, author and creator of the Scaling Up Framework, and to Lucy Summers, who's there behind the scenes, helping throw up our titles and getting our guests ready and scheduled and prepared and our show notes and all that kind of thing. Our audio is edited by Albert Burge at Podfly Productions. The show notes are written up by Ayn Kadena, proofread by Tim McGowan. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. Keep scaling up. We'll talk to you again next time. Bye-bye.